This week on Culture File, we're on a cicada safari in search of a once every couple of centuries occurrence. In the forest south of Chicago, in the summer of 2024, something happened that no living person has ever seen, or more accurately, heard. The periodic cicadas of the Midwest, one brood which comes above ground every 13 years and one which appears every 17 years, showed up together. Much to the interest and the delight, not just of entomologists, and conservationists, but also a travelling band of composers, musicians, poets, artists, filmmakers, and academics, drawn by the magnificent, thunderous, and delicate sounds of the multitudes. This week we're going to be meeting people whose work touches on the broods, and we start today with a taste of the voices, calls, and other sounds of our cicada safari.
Bugs, tone, one.
Their shell cracks open and they come out.
Coming.
Very vulnerable.
Emerging tone.
And they're this milky white color and soft when they come out. So it's kind of gross looking, but also kind of beautiful.
I think they're quite handsome, actually. I they're big red eyes or orange eyes, as people say. And also their bodies are very nicely symmetrical. You know, for an insect, some insects have grotesque bodies, but these guys are like real symmetrical. They look almost like something that a person would design as a sculpture, you know. So they're very sculpturesque, yeah.
Is that one or is that somebody else? Okay, he's just decided. They're quite metallic, aren't they? Okay, don't go into my top now. Please don't go into my top, because then you'll panic. Yes, he does. Do you want to talk?
What's that sound?
Like when they're in the tree, then they're happy out, like
right.
Nothing.
Right.
And even they're not so keen about getting off you. Like they'll just sort of sit there. And so, you know, this isn't going to do it.
Yeah.
So you have to kind of really, and of course they're climbers. So I would tuck one shirt in, right? So they have a habit of just kind of climbing up the leg and they'll just keep going.
Right.
And they're quite metallic feeling.
Mm.
It's quite a weird feeling.
Yeah.
And they will try and pierce because they don't think you're a tree.
Okay.
So it doesn't. There's a tiny little sting. It's not like it's not doing anything to you.
Yes.
They're not attacking you. They're not. They're not sucking your blood. But actually, that's a good point, Monkey. They feel
inside. It's on your shirt.
Like a little brooch now, if you just say that.
The other thing, didn't they have living brooches at some stage?
Oh, yeah. Probably not
The estimate is that they're about 1.5 million per acre.
What are you? I have to know.
It's there. I just heard it, like, did you find it?
I will put it back if you want. That might be better. He's going to keep on trying to go up.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's what flying insects do, is they try to fly up. So when we trap insects, we usually, if I'm using a net, I'm usually trying to come from behind and above it.
Yeah. Okay. There he is. He's on the inside. Where's he gone now?
Now I've got my shirt back on.
You got the wind, that's the wind, that's the wind.
Insect.
Who are we? Who are any of us? Do we have any idea? This is David Rothenberg, professor of philosophy and music at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. And I'm here to make music with bugs.
The man has made a habit. A habit I can be.
My name is Edwin Torres. I'm a poet.
So my name is Karen Power. I'm a composer. and sound artist, improviser, based in Cork, Ireland.
Who am I again?
Yes, I'm Jennifer Wells. I work at the California Institute of Integral Studies, a university in downtown San Francisco, California. And I specialize in complexity theories, environmental humanities, and an area called Real Utopia Studies, where we look at examples of projects, places that are doing fantastic transition that could be scaled up or learned from.
My name is Nagin Anwasi. I live in Chicago, and I work in the forest preserves of Cook County.
My name is Brian Rudy, and I live in Chicago, Illinois, and I'm a composer.
I was thinking of that idea, you know, that company Mockness was called, that was named after supposedly what happens when a calf is let out after the winter, and it sort of, apparently, yeah, so it jumps into the fields. And I was thinking this cicada period is like that sort of energy is what's in the air, but like a trillion times.
Yeah, the level of coordination that is, you know, inbuilt into the species, you know, that idea of gazillions of them all working together and in sync, and I mean, it's really mind-boggling. You know, you just think if we just pay a bit of attention to that, like, how does that work? How does that happen? How do they? I mean, I know they don't all find mates, but you know, to say that a number of them, enough of them, do to keep cycling, is extraordinary. And of course, one attraction is because they're such avid listeners themselves.
As part of the festivities around the rare emergence, film and TV composer Brian Rudy was commissioned to create a musical work in celebration of the cicadas to be performed on a summer's evening in the woods of Lincoln Memorial Park on the banks of Lake Springfield. The event was instigated by a US pest control brand, Orkin, who were quick to remind everybody that cicadas are not pests and are generally beneficial, and they won't be answering anyone's calls to remove them, but who did show up with a nice slogan for the event, a trillion piece performance 221 years in the making. The double emergence is a remarkable happening because the broods have life cycles presumably developed to avoid just such a clash, one emerging to breed every 13 years, the other every 17 years, the prime numbers making sure their arrivals coincide as infrequently as possible, an uncanny calculation, composer Brian Rudy celebrated in two melodies for his piece, one of 13 notes, one of 17 notes.
So that's 13 notes, and then the 17 note melody is. And you can play them together. Let's see if it's tricky to play them together. Let's see. That is a hacked up way to play it, but that's essentially how they go over the top of each other. Is a pest control company in the States called Orkin, and they have an advertising agency called DDB here in Chicago. They had been talking about this historic emergence of these two cicada broods, and Orkin thought it was a opportunity to do something that was a little more in tune with nature, as opposed to killing bugs. They thought, hey, this is a bug we can celebrate, because cicadas are pretty much beneficial, you know, to the environment and in a variety of ways. So they kind of tasked their advertising agency to come up with an idea of a way to celebrate this happening. So the team came up with this idea of doing, because the cicadas are so musical, they said, well, let's do something that's music oriented. And then they had the idea, let's have some music that is specifically composed to go with the cicadas and be, you know, have an event that's out in the forest. So this idea kind of snowballed. I remember last summer, you know, in our neighborhood here, we don't get a lot of the, especially this emergence, we haven't seen a lot of them. But I remember specifically last summer walking right over down the street on the sidewalk and hearing one and looking over and seeing it on the tree and studying it for a little bit because it was making that stereotypical sound, just wailing away. And I was fascinated by it.
People talk about the connection between electronic music and the sound of the cicada. Did that strike you on that moment?
Yeah, immediately, because they do a lot of, they make a few different sounds, but one of the things they tend to do is this starting slowly, then speeding up, and then slowing down, a lot like an LFO would modulate a sound. And then even the specific, if you break down the specific rhythmic sound, it's got a lot of complex little glitches and things going on, which is very reminiscent of, you know, different electronic sounds you can make. This idea of doing a concert evolved. Then the idea came up, well, let's do kind of a cycle of musical compositions that follow the life cycle of the cicadas, and each act will, you know, kind of tell the story in musical terms of their life. So that between the sounds that they make and then the skeleton of telling their story, that kind of became the framework that we started to work within. My concern was how loud, because they kept telling us how loud these things are, and I thought, is it going to drown out the music? Or it turned out just perfect. They were singing, and it ended up, you could hear when the music, I don't know if this was just coincidental or if they were responding to the music, but the music would go into quiet passages, and you could hear the cicadas kind of ramp up as if they're filling the sonic space. So it was pretty wild.
Did you see them that night at all?
Oh, they were everywhere. They were everywhere. And they, sadly, we each had our own little stage, our own little pods that we were on, the 10 musicians. And I was on a little keyboard stage, and they would come up on my stage and then just die. Like, I think it was maybe the end of their cycle there. So a lot of them had been alive for however many weeks or days, and that was the end. And they decided, I'm going to go up on this guy's keyboard stage and die here. It was very sad, actually.
Had you, I mean, you do have a part of the piece about the end of the cycle. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one of the pieces is called a requiem, you know, traditional requiem form, and it's a little tongue-in-cheek, you know, there's a big pipe organ and it's over the top, but you know, that's part of the spirit of how we did this thing, was over-dramatizing their lives.
questions. What was the best dream the past 17 years?
That's one of the issues we have with this. It's hard to study when you have to wait another 17 years to be like, oh, are you guys going to actually successfully do this or will it not happen? So some really cheeky scientists got it in their mind to take a peach orchard and cause the peach trees to go through fall twice in 1 year. So what they would do, they made the trees think there was less light than there was. So they think, oh, it's fall, time to drop our leaves. They did that. Then they let them see, oh, there's more light, time to redo that. And what we learned from this is how cicadas tell time. Because the cicadas came up in year 16 instead of year 17. And what we learned is that they track how the trees follow the seasons. Because the cicada nymphs, the baby cicadas, are sitting on the roots sucking up sap. So they'll monitor how the trees change sap flow. Because in fall, trees will decrease water in their sap flow because they don't want that water to freeze and freeze inside their cells. So cicadas monitor this, and when they came out in year 16, this told us that they're actually actively following what the trees are doing. And that's how they can tell time and know when 17 or 13 years have passed.
When you emerge, do you look back at the husk of before from this afterlife?
A lot of times when people first saw this, when settlers first arrived here, especially from Britain where cicadas aren't found, they thought they were looking at the biblical plagues of Egypt because there's all these insects out here and they're like, oh my God. But I like phrasing it like a party because everyone's been to like the big parties of the summer. That's all they're trying to do is throw a big party. And find the mate. So I like phrasing it that way to kind of dissuade people's fears because as scary and as loud as they can be, they're all big softies. They're not going to harm us.
Is time travel real?
Like all good parties, there's always a risk of STDs. And unfortunately, there's a cicada fungus called Massosporina that will kind of spread in a similar way. So Massosporina cicadina lives in the soil and will come up with the first cicadas that come up. And what it'll do is it's kind of similar to cordyceps. It will replace parts of the cicada's bodies with its spore body and will modify their behavior. It will cause male cicadas to mimic some of female behaviors in order to spread to other males.
You say cordyceps there, so that's a fascinating idea. Tell us a little bit more about what's happening when the spore gets control of the cicada.
What is the sound of your dreams?
What it'll do is it will change the behavior. So it'll have the males behave, copy some of the females' patterns during courtship. So the way periodical cicada courtship works is that they will kind of, the males will call, then the females will approach, flick their wings. Males will go into another call, and this will go on for two or three cycles. But what this will do is it'll make the male cicadas act like females. So they'll approach another male, flick their wings like a female would, and then the male will keep singing, and the infected cicada will go through the whole courtship process before or being able to spread the sporing body to the abdomen of the unsuspecting male.
Any news from the muses?
During an attempted sexual encounter.
Yes.
Yeah. That is one of the wackiest stories I've heard.
Yes, it is crazy, but it's all a product of how specialized their biology is that this wouldn't work with any other insect. But it does work with periodical cicadas just because they have such a unique specialized strategy for how their life cycle works. Or it's like any other insect, this would fail because you wouldn't be able to find enough hosts. But because these insects are out in trillions, this strategy works for Massospora.
What do you long to do with your shed exoskeleton?
What's a typical, you know, you said this community of cicada lovers, what's a typical member of that community like? Can you describe that person?
Yeah. It's a mix. We have people who are working professionally, like Chris Simon, Gene Kritsky, Chris Alley Krautzer, who will be actually doing a wonderful book coming up on the cicadas of North America.
I was thinking of what kind of personality types, though.
the best thing you need is I'll be honest, the best thing you need is a good sense of hearing.
What's inside you that prepares you for when it's time?
And just a curiosity about the world around you. The ability to question and hear a sound and say, "What's that sound?" If you don't have that curiosity, you'll get frustrated because you'll hear this buzzing sound and you'll be like, "Oh, it's just a buzzing sound." But for us, it's like, "Okay, you're not a round tip cone head, katydid. What are you? I have to know."
Do you think we should all emerge every once in a while?
I've always loved the sound of insects. I just think there's something quite amazing about something that's so small that emits such a powerful call, and variety of call, and they all have these cyclical patterns in their call. So when you listen to them, you're immediately aware of macro and micro. And I don't think there are many other species where that's so obvious. So for me, that's what I'm attracted to. So right now, you know, we're hearing this blanket. And within that blanket, there are calls coming from my left and calls coming from my right. And sort of somewhere in that middle, you get that sense of motion. It's the hypnotic, again, going back to that sense of, something that kind of just pulls you in sonically and wraps around you. For me, that's what it feels like. I suppose there's a couple of very interesting things, one of which is just an observation from being here, and I guess the other is part of what I would have known coming in. And I think what makes these, the periodic cicadas, particularly interesting, is just the amount of variety. So like in any cicada sound, I would always describe it as like this wall of sound with these tiny moments of like as if somebody is just trying to peek through it, right? Push a little sound through the wall. But here we're getting that, but we're also getting this motion and we're getting the depth. So we have the traditional kind of, you know, high cicadas, which actually work very well with the wind here. And then you work downwards. So you have these, I'm not sure if everybody would hear the layers, but I hear layers. So I hear a kind of a top layer band, which I would say is probably about like maybe an octave deep, way up. And then I hear the next band, which is where that call, the long call, will happen.
This is the pharaoh thing.
The pharaoh thing. Yes, which is where that will happen. And we were just talking about this a while ago. So I've been hearing some of those calls are sometimes a slightly different pitch. So you're getting this kind of sonic cluster if you hear a few of them. And of course, they don't. Synchronize either. So you might hear a call, one is ending but the other is still going, and it's a slightly different pitch. It's almost like difference pitch. And then underneath that is this elusive kind of hum that I've been chasing for the 5 days that I'm here. I've been trying to get closer to it. I heard it pretty well. You hear it better in the morning, I think, before these guys kind of do what they do, but that to me was a complete surprise, and it fills out the whole harmonic spectrum beautifully. So lots to work with.
Part of what's happening here with David Rothenberg and the people that's with him, musicians, the idea that the cicadas are listening creatures, so they're listening to us, so that that's one of the points of making music with and to them. How are you feeling about the relationship of the human music makers and the insect music makers? You were saying earlier, like when you're going to play with David and everybody, you're not going to use sounds that you've collected here so as not to be competing. That's like one of your thoughts anyway. Maybe.
Yeah. I mean, that for me would seem like an obvious, you know, just to avoid any confusion. I suppose, you know, I'm using field recordings here. Now, most of them are processed, but so they're sounds from all over the world. Like, what happens if I play a cicada sound from South America to a cicada here? Do they suddenly get excited and think there's something? I don't know. So that's my point, is that there's a lot I don't know.
Could be like first contact with outer space or something.
Yes, I would be proud to facilitate that first contact. Like, it's great to have a group like this of very different people with different backgrounds and different interests coming together and just chatting with people and, you know, just, I think if anybody is going to test this and try this, then the fact that it's artists, I'm very reassured by, because we are listeners and we are generally incredibly sensitive to our environment and what's happening around, and obviously as an improviser, that's doubly so. So in that respect, I think it could be kind of exciting also for maybe what it could unearth for maybe the science community who are going off on their own path to communicate with the animals. Like, maybe, you know, there's something there that maybe artists could offer a perspective that they might not have considered. So that could be exciting.
There is this kind of movement in AI to, you know, where large language models are what's going on, and they're about translating from one language to another. And there is then this assumption that you should be able to translate animal sounds into something we could understand. And that's proceeding as a sort of research area without much feeling of what that could mean.
Yeah. So that's where my worry comes from, is hearing about those kinds of experiments that are, as you say, proceeding. There's so much presumption, and it comes back to deep within my own practice of, you know, the idea of like, I choose to go to places where humans are not top dog, for the reason that it's humbling, and it allows you to experience a different life, a different sense of the way life works, and I think that's kind of, that knowledge should be what's put first if you're going to explore through AI and communicate with an animal. But I fear it's maybe not, because it's nuanced. There's no right answer.
Karen Power there, beneath the trees filled with cicadas in Illinois, bringing to a close our cicada safari on the Culture File Weekly. You heard also Thoughts and Sounds by Brian Rudy, Negin Almasi, Zach Salas, David Rothenberg, Edwin Torres, Jennifer Wells, William Russell, and somewhere north of a million cicadas, to all of whom, many thanks. Until next week, bye now.